I think most of you have met Christopher Innes already. He's with us from York University in Canada, and we're here for his talk this morning. Christopher Innes.
Firstly, I should say I'm delighted to be here, and I'd like to, of course, thank the Sloan Foundation and KITB for having me. Yesterday, we had a lot of comments about the importance of titles and how titles come to be the first thing you think about, and the difference between macro and micro levels of analysis. And when Bill asked me for a title for this talk, I gave a thoroughly general description, which is in your program, Science on the Stage in Arcadia and Copenhagen, which may be a kind of literally accurate sort of description, but is terribly boring and rather too broad to be useful, particularly when one only has half an hour to play with. So I'd like to zero in on my topic by offering a completely different title, which is Staging Science, Chorus Girls, and Skeletons. Okay?
I like it better.
Sexier, right. So far today, I wasn't in the panel that talked about scientists as protagonists. We've had characterization, we've had writing of drama, and now I want to look at a third central aspect of plays, which is structure. Before I do so, let me just step back a bit. Last September, as many of us are aware, there was another conference about science and the stage in Darkest Wales. And there, Frayn's play Copenhagen got discussed so often that it achieved no-name brand status. And one of the other most frequent references was to a British physicist from the 1950s, C.P. Snow, who was also sort of serviced here indirectly, and who was, of course, notorious because he claimed that scientific advances had inevitably divided society into two cultures that couldn't talk to each other. Couldn't even understand each other. Now, in Wales, it was widely felt that this no longer held true, but there was no consensus on defining what a science play might be. Now, that's a broad question that I raised yesterday in the panel discussion, and to set the context for what I want to talk about today, just a brief reprise of one point. In his program to the London production of Oxygen, Carl Gerassi, the inventor of the contraceptive pill, characteristically dismissed Brecht, Dürermatt, Whitmore, and Stoppard for not having science as their main focus. He said they didn't count as science in theatre. And
so like a scientist.
Sorry?
So like a scientist.
So like a scientist. Well, so like a medical scientist, maybe. He did, however, manage to have faint praise for Copenhagen. Faint. He said, Frayn made no concession to scientific illiteracy. So his play was okay. I'd like to offer a slightly different view. And I want to suggest that it's precisely because Arcadia, precisely Stoppard himself, that can be seen as taking the whole notion of a science play to a new level, one that Copenhagen then follows. And the crucial factor is the structure of these two plays. They stand out because, in addition to presenting scientific themes and scientific characters, their dramatic structure incorporates the science that is then discussed in the dialogue. In fact, we had an excellent example of precisely this last night in the play that Penny Penniston wrote, Now, Then, Again, which of course dramatizes Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, Schrödinger's box, and so on, by replaying the action in reverse so that potential realities increasingly diverge. An extremely clear demonstration of structure carrying a scientific message. In one of his early film reviews, to get to the chorus girls, Stoppard referred to a Richard Attenborough movie, The Angry Silence, as blending entertainment and education as completely as a row of chorus girls explaining Einstein's theory of light. We talked about MacGuffins yesterday too, and in a sense those chorus girls would be a MacGuffin. And in Hapgood, the play Stoppard wrote immediately before Arcadia, he has precisely his theory of light explained by glamorous spies, which might be the Le Carré substitute for chorus girls. Every time we don't look, we get wave pattern, says the Russian double agent. Every time we look to see how we get wave pattern, we get particle pattern. I'm not doing a Russian accent, Jeremy, too early in the morning. Somehow light is particle and wave. The experimenter, when you're speaking as a scientist, makes the choice. You get, now speaking as a spy, what you interrogate for. So there's an overlap between those two levels. Similarly, in Arcadia, which combines chaos theory, fractal geometry, the laws of thermodynamics, on the one hand, with English landscape gardening, the history of aesthetics, the switch from neoclassical rationalism to Gothic romanticism, Lord Byron, and academic biography. The science is post-Einsteinian. The social history is social history in its most frivolous aspect, gardening, and even more frivolous, cutthroat scholarly competition. And the sex accompanies it pretty explicitly on both levels of the play, which is the equivalent of those chorus girls. But underpinning both the scientific principles and the sexy social scene, whether the past or the present, is a single structure, by which I don't mean the plot, but the way in which the dramatic action is patterned, which may be far more subtle, indeed more complicated, than Penny's rather clear patterning of mirror imaging, and perhaps less obvious, but is just as effective, I think, on a subliminal level. In Arcadia, on the most obvious level, there are, of course, two time frames for the action. 1809, in the days leading up to a fire that kills the young protagonist in the first half of the play, Thomasina on the eve of her 17th birthday, and at the same country house in the present day, so two time scenes. But the scenes of one time frame actually replicate and are designed to replicate the scenes of the other, in much the same way as the fractals that Thomasina is said to have discovered replicate each other. When Thomasina realizes that in repeating, or in mathematical terms, iterating an equation with the solution being fed back into the next equation, produces a constant geometrical pattern, she's actually outlining the structure of the play itself. In simplest terms, as explained by Valentine, a computer expert in the contemporary scenes, the numbers translate into graphs. I think we're going to get that bit of scene read for us later. But each graph is identical, as far as Valentine is concerned, formed from a small section of the previous one, blown up like you blow up a detail of a photograph, and then a detail of a detail, and so on. Forever. Now, Valentine is using this kind of geometry for totally trivial reasons, again getting back to the chorus girls, but these trivial reasons are to explain historical changes in the grouse population of a shooting moor, as recorded in the family game book. Not a very scientific source, I think. But the point of using this non-Euclidean geometry as a structure of the play is that fractals, in Stoppard's view, correspond to the workings of nature. And this was emphasized by the program for the National Theatre production, the original production, which had an essay by a research professor from the Royal Society in London, stating that the mathematics of chaos offer new and deep insights into the structure of the world around us. So Stoppard is intending to do the same with his play. And along the same lines, corresponding to the way each fractal expands a detail of the previous one into a comparable whole, although both halves of the play occupy the same number of scenes, the 1809 scenes cover 4 years, while the contemporary scenes occupy a single day. And those 4 years take half the actual stage time of the present day scenes. So you can see, as it were, the same fractal equation being expanded to the present day. Similarly, the relationships between the characters in each time frame mirror each other with variations that expand during the play. In both 1809 and the present, there's, of course, a teacher, Septimus, the old style family tutor, Bernard, the trendily up-to-date university professor. Each publishes slashing reviews that outrage a writer. In the past, it's the incompetent poet, romantic poet, Chater. In the present, it's the non-academic feminist historian, Hannah. Each of these teachers is loved by the daughter of the house, Thomasina Chloe. In each one of the family, Thomasina or Valentine is fascinated by the behavior of numbers and uses the same type of mathematics. So you can see the parallels working very clearly. In each half, Byron is very much on everyone's mind, but is never present, right? Never found. And in each half, too, there's one character, Gus or Augustus in the past, who is present on both levels. So there's an absence and a presence that, in a sense, shouldn't be there. And these two structural equations, however similar, work out very differently. So, for example, Bernard successfully seduces Chloe, possibly her mother too, while Septimus's refusal to be seduced by Thomasina leads to her death. And there are also other common elements between the two, such as that tortoise, which rather bugs me, because apart from the Galapagos, I don't know of tortoises that live for over 184 years. But this tortoise is the evidence about all sorts of other things that has to be there. And the tortoise, of course, is called Plautus in the past. And very ironically, because it never moves, lightning in the present. In addition, the same patterning recurs from scene to scene in the historical and contemporary frames. And this is underlined by the stage directions in the first edition of the play, which echoed most closely the production. So you have directions stating that this scene is a reprise. You have other stage directions reminding us that of a previous scene, we have seen this composition before. In other words, Stoppard is really pointing out the parallels, the compositional fractals. At the same time, mimicking that expanding graph, whenever characters put anything on the central table that occupies the stage in both past and present scenes, it remains there. Now, a modern coffee cup remains on the table in a kind of multiplying collection of objects. Now, one of those objects, apart from the coffee cup, is an apple. An apple offered by the shy Gus to Hannah, then picked up by Thomasina in 1809, who uses a leaf from it to plot the equation that will demonstrate, quote, how nature is written in numbers. It's then picked up again in the present by Valentine, who uses it to explain, quote, how a picture of this leaf could be made by iterating the right algorithm. The apple is, of course, not just an apple. We've talked a lot about metaphors in this conference, and the apple is a metaphor. Well, it's simultaneously emblematic of Newtonian physics, that famous apple falling on Newton's head while he was sleeping in an orchard, laws of gravity on the rest, and of course is the apple that Eve used to seduce Adam in another orchard, the Garden of Eden. As Valentine puts it, again something that's been quoted before and again something that's going to be read to us, I think, today, love is the attraction that Newton left out, all the way back to the apple in the garden. And indeed, in the biblical Garden of Eden, you could see Eden as the equivalent of the classical Arcadia, title of the play, of course, and underlined by Stoppard in his title, but also picked up in the landscape of the country house. Hannah, the historian of landscape gardening, extols the formal Italianate 1730s garden as having been paradise in the age of reason. While Lady Croom of 1809 sees herself surrounded by the picturesque naturalism of Capability Brown's garden that has replaced it as being, again a quotation, here in Arcadia. For modern day Hannah, the 1809 remodeling of the park into a romantic wilderness, complete of course with Septimus as the hermit in a hermitage, makes the landscaper with his early steam pump the serpent in the scheme of the garden. So this Garden of Eden theme runs all the way through the play. And it's that steam engine, as well as stirring jam into a bowl of rice pudding, that of course brings Thomasina to deduce the principles of entropy by revealing that the heat equation only goes one way, which Septimus realizes means we're all doomed, since this undermines the conservation of energy predicted by Newton. Newton gives a picture of a stable universe. Thomasina's universe is anything but stable. However, as she points out, you can't do anything about the science. Once the laws of thermodynamics are taken into account, the improved, as she calls it, Newtonian universe must cease and grow cold. Now that seems a bleak vision of existence, and the play is sometimes seen as a statement of existential despair, because of course Thomasina dies in a fire while she's asleep, and Septimus spends the rest of his life alone apart from that tortoise in the hermitage, covering mountains of paper in an attempt to either disprove or to prove her equations. Yet, while entropy, like all human life, may be a one-way passage to extinction, the Newtonian physics, which thermodynamics displaced, is seen by Stoppard as being totally deterministic. In other words, Newtonian physics rules out free will. By contrast, Thomasina's new geometry of irregular forms offers a positive alternative, since mathematically it's the opposite of entropy. In oceans of ashes, islands of order, patterns making themselves out of nothing. There's also, of course, another form of creation that the play stresses. The traditional definition of thermodynamics is the action of bodies in heat. And that is also a description of sexual activity, which preoccupies all of the characters in both time frames. In terms of the plot, Arcadia celebrates physical love. And this goes along with its fractal-like structure, in which the first equation, 1809, and the second, 1995, or the present, merge to become the root of a third equation with the last scene of the play. Occupying the same space, the focus switches increasingly swiftly between these two time frames, until in the final moment Hannah finds herself dancing in the embrace of Gus, who of course in fancy dress is the Augustus of the 1809 scenes from the historical period, together with the other pair of Thomasina and Septimus, who I've seen it done other ways, but who waltz around each other in a single image of unity. So they have finally broken through, as it were, the entropic logic of time in this merging of past and present, so that this kind of post-Euclidean geometry is being presented as the ultimate affirmation of human value, human possibility. Science, in other words, in the form of chaos theory and mathematical algorithms, is presented as the guarantor of human fulfillment, emotional freedom, and so on. To just very briefly sketch the same structural elements in Copenhagen, Frayn's play, which of course follows Arcadia just 3 years later, is even less realistic than Stoppard's, since none of the characters actually have material bodies or even living existence. In the conceit of the play, as everyone knows, everyone's dead, present only in an afterlife of memory. Yet both of these plays share the same, I think, essential feature. Like Stoppard, Frayn is using the principles of scientific laws at the core of the discussion as a structure for the scenes of the play itself. The play, of course, revolves around Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and Bohr's theory of complementarity, which, together with the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, which I've just been informed is totally outdated, but anyway, provides the basis for nuclear physics. And every aspect of the play is designed to embody the concept of the universe defined by this proto-modern science. Even the status of ghosts, of course, parallels Schrödinger's imaginary cat. These characters are dead and alive at the same time. More specifically, they are responsible for ushering in the atomic age and are seen in terms of their own theories. They are said, quote, to live inside an atom. And the metaphor is worked out down to the way actors' movements are choreographed on the stage. As Heisenberg remarks, Copenhagen is an atom. Margrethe, Bohr's wife, who transcribed, of course, all his theories, is its nucleus. Bohr's an electron. He's wandering about the city. I'm a photon. How much more explicit can you get? A quantum of light. I'm dispatched into the darkness to find Bohr, and I succeed because I managed to collide with him. Same time, complementarity is used constantly in the play to define a theme in which, quote, physics is also politics. This of course, is physics going into metaphysics and so on, which is one of Frayn's and indeed Stoppard's major points, where the two opposing scientists are mirror images of each other, and then complementarity combined with the uncertainty principle, or the more precise term Frayn suggests in his postscript to the play, indeterminability, which correlates to memory. Heisenberg and Bohr can't even agree, if you remember, whether they spoke together in German, Danish, or English. Uncertainty also defines a central action. The visit, of course, made by Heisenberg to his old mentor Bohr in September 1941, during the German occupation of Denmark. The characters revisited just indeed as the Bohr family and Heisenberg himself have revisited it in memoirs, in letters to the press, and so on, subsequent to the play. And the long-dead protagonists themselves are presented, if you like, in a kind of afterlife, like the half-life of the deadly radiation that follows an atomic explosion. I've actually seen a very interesting German production of the play in which Heisenberg was presented as a film, well, he was played by an actor who was a popular film star. And in the German context, that really altered the play significantly. He was also given a real relationship with Margarete, who treated him as a son, you know, constantly touching on the shoulder or whatever. And the play was performed in a theater in the round where the audience were very close to the actors and was set in a kind of swimming pool with water and a little toy boat and photographs on the bottom of the water and metallic plates on which the characters stood and walked. So it was Denmark, but also a nuclear reactor. It was a kind of interesting, very interesting production, but I don't have time to talk about it now. My point really is that both Frayn and Stoppard are creating structures in their drama that illustrate, indeed embody, the science, and that's imaginatively, at least to me, a far more interesting way of reflecting science on the stage than simply discussing scientific principles through the mouths of the characters. Thank you.